In 2014, Louisiana State Representative Katrina Jackson, a Democrat, introduced Louisiana's Unsafe Abortion Protection Act, which requires those who perform abortions to meet the same medical standards that any physician would have to who practices at any hospital. If you're going to perform abortions in the state of Louisiana, stated Representative Jackson in 2014, you're going to do so in a safe environment and in a safe manner that offers women the optimal protection and care of their bodies, unquote. Since that time, abortion activists have been fighting to defeat this common sense law. In 2020, the U.S. Supreme Court will consider Louisiana's law, representing yet another instance of the high court turning to consider abortion since the court's invention of abortion rights in Roe v. Wade by seven men in 1973, and its wiping out of democratically enacted life-affirming laws in nearly every state. Alexander DeSantis, staff writer at National Review, returns to Life, Liberty, and Law to discuss the U.S. Supreme Court's next opportunity to address abortion and to help unpack a just-released Americans United for Life YouGov national poll concerning the substantive health and safety issues at the heart of the Louisiana law that the High Court will consider. I'm Tom Shakley, and this is Life, Liberty, and Law. Welcome to Life, Liberty, and Law. I am Tom Shakley, and I'm joined today by friend of the show, Alexandra DeSantis. Alexandra, so good to have you back.
Great to be back with you both.
And we've also got Noah Brandt here from Americans United for Life.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, so we're here to talk about June Medical Services versus Gee. This is the Supreme Court case that is resulting from Representative Katrina Jackson's 2014 law, the Unsafe Abortion Protection Act. We can go over a bit about what this law is and what this case, the U.S. Supreme Court, is going to be considering, what its scope is. In short, June Medical refers to the pro-abortion constituency, and Gee refers to Dr. Rebecca Gee, the secretary of the Louisiana Department of Health, who's responsible in that capacity for regulating, you know, medicine, health, and safety for Louisianans. This is, I think, a case that many pro-life people have been paying attention to as it's wound its way through the courts over many years. And there's a lot of interest in it, but I don't think Americans in general are aware of this yet.
Yeah, I think that's the case, and I think that's understandable. It's kind of a technical issue that's being dealt with here. It's a little bit difficult to explain what exactly is at stake, and it's a little bit attenuated from sort of the typical, do you support abortion rights or don't you? Because there's not really any limit on the abortion procedure itself that's being debated here. But I also think part of the reason for that, maybe we'll get to this a bit more, but the sort of pro-abortion rights side doesn't like to talk about this case to some extent because they don't want to be seen as arguing against a restriction that would supposedly probably help women's health.
Yeah, this is, I mean, the key thing here that, I mean, Americans United for Life focuses on the women's right to healthcare. This should be a bipartisan common sense issue, you know, the issue of whether women patients have a right to be treated by a properly licensed physician, somebody who can ensure they have immediate emergency room access when, not if, but when abortion complications will arise for some percentage of those women that threaten their life. And yet we're in a position where this is being hailed as another case of extremism from Americans who are life-affirming. I mean, it's kind of hard to believe, but it's easy if you're not paying attention to the issues closely.
I think it's interesting to think about. So, you know, every year in the United States, there's literally hundreds of cases involving abortion, people challenging regulations, people suing abortion clinics, people suing the government, and they're winding their way through district courts and court of appeals. But it doesn't really matter too much at the end of the day because the U.S. Supreme Court has such a tight hold on abortion policy in America. And the U.S. Supreme Court, as you know, Alexander, decides to take very few abortion cases. So when they decide to take one, as they did with this, it's a huge deal. So even though, as you said, it's sort of a technical case, the issue is not as clear as some other ones. It's really, really important because anytime the Supreme Court rules on abortion, it sets important precedent.
So what is June Medical, the abortion interest, arguing in this case, essentially? They're fighting for the right to abandon their patients, frankly. You know, in no other practice of medicine would patient abandonment be acceptable. But in this case, June Medical is stepping in and making a kind of a bizarre argument. They're saying, actually, we are the only ones who can represent women in the case, even though they are the abortion provider. And even though no women in Louisiana have stood up to say they have a problem with the law that was enacted so many years ago under Representative Katrina Jackson's leadership. I mean, what other analogy would there be for a business, a for-profit business, maybe stepping in to say essentially that our customers don't have standing to contest what we want for them?
I can't think of any where it would be allowed by the court. I mean,
Noah?
What's so silly about this case and so many abortion cases, so there are so many abortion cases, like a very famous one was in 1992, Planned Parenthood v. Casey, right? Who is the litigant in that? It's Planned Parenthood, the abortion provider. The abortion provider is suing the state because of a safety regulation intended for Planned Parenthood's patients, their customers. And in no other situation or business do you have a for-profit enterprise, or at least a profit-making enterprise such as Planned Parenthood or another abortion clinic, being able to sue the government for safety regulations that are intended to help their patients, which they regularly put at risk. And things can go wrong and things do go wrong, right?
Yeah, that's one of the things I think is so interesting about this case is the court's considering not only whether the state is permitted to regulate abortionists in this way, which is a huge issue, but at the same time, they're considering whether or not it's appropriate or, you know, whether abortion providers have standing to sue in this capacity, which has been done, as Noah just said, that would be one huge example. But this sort of thing happens all the time. And it's almost as if they're kind of fighting for their right to perform an abortion. And there's no such right. That has not been declared by any
exactly.
court.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. And that's not even the people who are pro-abortion or pro the right to abortion. That's not at least how they usually articulate the case. But that's what the abortion providers are trying to say here, is that even more important than a woman's right to abortion is our right to perform an abortion, even if the standard of safety is lower than what the state wants, right?
Correct. Or even lower than what's enforced for other types of healthcare procedures.
One of the things that has been brought to the fore from this issue is that, you know, people are looking back a few years ago in 2016 when the U.S. Supreme Court considered a sort of a similar case in the form of a Texas law, the Hellerstedt case. And one of the things in the Texas case is whether an undue burden would be placed on women seeking abortion if the law were allowed to stand. In Louisiana, there were five abortion businesses that were a part of this initial lawsuit when it began 5 years ago. So what's happened to those five abortion businesses? Two of them have closed since that time for reasons unrelated to the Louisiana law. One was closed after the Louisiana Department of Health charged it with failing to report the rape of a young girl. And the other was closed after the Louisiana Department of Health charged that it did an abortion on a young girl without her parents' knowledge or permission. Of these five, you have sort of an example of abortion clinics across the country. These are a representative sample of what abortion is as a business. Abortion centers tend to be dirty. They tend to be dangerous. They tend to be harmful places. I mean, the practices there are inherently harmful to both patients, both the woman, you know, the mother, and their children. But in Louisiana, we don't anticipate the undue burden issue coming out, right? Because there's not a clear one-to-one result where if the court rules a certain way on the Louisiana law, it will not end abortion in the state as it might have to some degree in Texas, right?
Yeah, that's right. I think that's one really important thing about this case is a lot of pro-life people were very clearly, obviously, disheartened by the result in the Hellerstedt case because that seemed to foreclose the possibility of states regulating abortion at any point. And one thing that isn't talked about very much is the fact that even under Roe and Casey, states are permitted to restrict abortion later in pregnancy because the court acknowledged that the state has an interest, a compelling interest later in pregnancy to begin to protect the life of the developing fetus, even as they don't, you know, impose this supposedly undue burden on women, which whatever that means. And as we've seen, courts tend to interpret it very much in favor of the right to abortion.
And it means everything.
Right. But at the same time, there are states that have 20-week bans. There are states that have health and safety regulations. Some of these things have been allowed to stand. And so I think a case like this will be a huge indication of whether the court, as it's currently comprised, is willing to leave room for any sorts of regulations at all, even ones that are only to protect the health and safety of the women going in there. So, I mean, it's absurd that that wouldn't be allowed to stay in place.
One of the things that we're shadowboxing with this case to a degree is the fact that the Supreme Court has, since the 1970s, more or less made up and changed its standards for what constitutes its abortion jurisprudence. So you started out with the trimester framework. And I think if you talk to the average person, they might think the trimester framework is still in place, that it wasn't overturned in the 1992 Planned Parenthood versus Casey. They might think of phrases like viability. They might think of phrases like undue burden. But the court has this kind of constantly shifting perspective on the fundamental or non-fundamental nature of the right to abortion as it's conceived it, on the scope of abortion, broadly speaking, on what particular states are allowed to do. And so, you know, in a certain sense, if we were to put ourselves in the shoes of abortion activists, we can understand why they are constantly ringing the alarm bells, because they're kind of acknowledging what we're all witnessing, which is that, you know, to some degree, who knows what the U.S. Supreme Court's going to do? We're just in a strange place.
And you made a good point, Tom. Every time the Supreme Court really takes up abortion and really wrestles with it, they come to completely different conclusions than they did before. So in Roe, it's like the original interest for the right to abortion they found was that they said that abortion, even though it's not enumerated in the Constitution, has such a strong history in the character of America, and it's such an important part of freedom in the United States that it needs to be legal. And by 1992, whenever they reconsidered it, that was such a farcical notion, right? That had been, I mean, it wasn't true in the 70s, but it was had been completely disproven by 92. Abortion was illegal throughout most of American history. So in 92, they came up with the reliance interest, this idea that women rely upon abortion so it can't be banned. And if it comes up again, I'm sure they'll come up with a different interest because it's been disproven that women rely on abortion, right?
Yeah, and I think that's a great point, Neil. This ridiculous notion that women need abortion in order to be equal to men. It's essentially saying that women must be the same as men in order to flourish, which is about as unfeminist an idea as I could think of. But I think this whole conversation just reminds us again why something like abortion should not be decided by courts and why the issue is still so polarized. You know, this comes up all the time in my writing and in conversations that I have. People ask, why has the abortion issue not been settled? And why, you know, we have this ruling, why can't people just move on? And I think people rightly understand that this is something that's really complicated and that people have very different views on, and every state should be allowed to enact its policy. And the reason pro-life people tend to be, by and large, so much more vociferous about this issue is because our policies never get put in place. So if you look at what happened in New York, Virginia, I guess that law didn't end up passing, but some of these abortion expansions earlier this year, especially in New England states, they all passed and no one really shrugged. We all kind of shrugged and moved on, with a few exceptions. But then when you look into the South, where these heartbeat bills are being passed, they're all held up in court. Some of them have been blocked already. The Alabama bill has been blocked. You know, these pro-life bills are blocked because of Roe and because of Casey. And so when you have this kind of landscape, I think it's immensely clear that the American people should be able to enact, or Congress should be able to enact, its own statutes on the matter, instead of having people whose views we have to guess at, you know, kind of expounding on these things every decade and telling us what we're supposed to think and what policies we're supposed to have.
You're so right. And the problem is the people, the Supreme Court, at least themselves, they seem to think that we need to be involved to make this clear. We need to be involved to, like, delineate the truth. But all they do is sow doubt. You know, the Planned Parenthood v. Casey, that majority opinion written by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, starts with this sentence, quote, "Liberty finds no refuge in a jurisprudence of doubt." But all the Supreme Court does is sow doubt when it comes to the abortion debate and abortion across the country. They make things less clear, not more clear.
And the fact that they have to step in every time is what makes it less clear. Because every time a law passes, we all just have to sit and wait while it works its way through the court until the Supreme Court decides whether or not they're actually going to clarify for us whether this particular one's allowed.
As and they try to figure it out themselves, frankly, exactly. Right?
Right, and they keep thinking we'll be able to come up with this perfect standard or this perfect test. But newsflash, it doesn't exist. So all they do every decade or every 15 years is come up with this new arbitrary idea that we're all trying to sort of compare these laws to, and it just obfuscates the truth and makes things more complicated, not easier to understand.
Yeah, Carter Sneed at Notre Dame Center for Ethics and Culture has spoken on this really compellingly, and in particular, you know, he cites Anthony Kennedy's remarks in the Supreme Court's writing when they considered partial birth abortion in the early 2000s. And Kennedy writes something to the effect of, you know, in a sort of a tone of lamentation, once again, you know, we turn to the issue of abortion. And Carter, you know, makes the point. He says, of course, you're going to continue to turn to it because it is an invention of the court. And that's just an echo of what Clarence Thomas wrote recently in really stark terms and saying, you know, because the court created this right, it's duty bound to address its scope. So it's going to continue coming up. And I think So all of this is context for what the Supreme Court's going to consider in 2020, which will be a pivotal year regardless, but especially when it comes to this particular Louisiana law. And so I think we can be proud of Louisiana Representative Katrina Jackson, one of the rare today pro-life Democrats who was the lead sponsor on this law that abortionists are fighting so hard. We can be proud of Dr. Rebecca Gee, the Secretary of the Department of Health in Louisiana, and so many prominent women who are advocating for science, advocating for medicine, advocating for basic health and safety against a lobby that is increasingly backed into a corner. In Box versus Planned Parenthood, Planned Parenthood came out and said explicitly, yes, we favor the idea of aborting a child because it's a girl. Yes, we favor the idea of aborting a child because it's black. Yes, we favor aborting a child because of its ability or disability status. When you are backed into those kind of corners, it's clear you'll do or say anything to preserve what you believe is a good status quo. But it's a status quo that doesn't hold up to the light of reality. And this takes us to the findings of a recent poll that is being released now from Americans United for Life in partnership with YouGov, a nonpartisan national polling firm. Some really interesting data on this in light of the Louisiana law. We wanted to figure out, what do Americans think about the substantive issues at the heart of the Louisiana law? I think when you look at national polling on issues like Roe v. Wade, you'll see polls from time to time done on Roe, and Alexander, you've probably seen more of these than anybody, where they'll sort of ask people generally, what do you think of Roe? And people don't know what Roe is, so they kind of just give answers, and you end up with polls that tell you weird things, right?
It's so frustrating to me. These questions, you know, about, oh, well, are you pro-choice or pro-life? Or people don't know what's in Roe. Some, you know, not a majority, but maybe about 40% of Americans don't even know that Roe had to do with abortion. But we're supposed to believe that when 7 in 10 of them say they want to keep Roe, that's, you know, synonymous with supporting abortion on demand until birth. So the polling is generally very unhelpful. That's why I love these polls that are commissioned by people who understand what the specific issues are at stake in the abortion debate, where we get answers from Americans on what they believe about very specific questions like, you know, would you support abortion in this particular circumstance? Or would you support a policy restricting abortion after 20 weeks? That's the only way we can actually gauge public opinion on abortion.
Because just asking people about sort of these abstractions, like, do you support Roe? It's confusing. It would be like giving someone a poll, like, do you support the Bush doctrine instead of, like, did you support the 2003 invasion of Iraq? Yeah. Like, you need to ask a specific question to get a specific answer.
Especially when people are lied to about Roe so often. I mean,
well, and it deals with that bias, too. If you're asked about some doctrine, you don't want to feel silly. You're going to say, of course I know what that is. Yeah, of course. And here's my firm opinion on this thing I'm just learning about. Okay, so before we get into the specifics of the poll results, I'm wondering, you know, as we look at what Louisiana's intending to do with their law, Alexandra, could you speak to situations in which the sort of emergency transfers where a patient, a mother, might need to be transferred from an abortion clinic to a hospital, where they might be necessary? You know, what's driving this law?
Sure. So I'm not a medical doctor. I can't speak to the specific complications of abortion procedures, but I've read enough about this. I read certainly enough about Dr. Gosnell's horrible, horrific abortion clinic outside Philadelphia, where there are just nightmare situations going on. But my understanding is, even in an abortion clinic where, you know, so-called everything is sanitary and safe, this is still a very complicated procedure that's going on. This is oftentimes late in pregnancy. It's a surgical abortion. It involves it's an invasive procedure. And so for any type of invasive surgical procedure, doctors are expected to be able to admit their patient to a hospital, to go with them to the hospital, and to ensure that they're okay if anything happens. And these sorts of things happen a lot with abortion. And again, the data on this is kind of shaky, I think, because a lot of people don't want us to know what the data is on these sorts of complications. But women face problems a lot of the time with incomplete abortions, or they're sent home when the abortion actually failed and they still have part of their child inside them, these sorts of horrific things, you know, bleeding, horrible things that women have to face that oftentimes results in them later being infertile or having other health problems. And so the idea that we would let doctors off the hook and not have to at least get their patient to a hospital is absurd.
Recently, the head litigator on behalf of these abortion agencies was interviewed talking about this exact claim, right? Why don't abortionists need hospital admitting privileges? Why shouldn't they be able to take their patients to the emergency room if there's an emergency? And his answer was laughable. His answer was literally, for a hospital to give a doctor admitting privileges, the doctor needs to use them fairly often. abortions are so safe that they never have to go to the hospital. So therefore, hospitals don't want to grant abortionists admitting privileges to their hospital. So his argument was just that abortions are just so safe that hospitals just say, you know, not worth it giving you the ID card. The fact that this accomplished lawyer would be saying this, and I'm sure he's not going to say this in court. He'd just say it to friendly media outlets. But I think it's important for listeners to understand that that is not true. Abortion is not the safest procedure that you can get.
The reason that he could make this kind of argument is precisely because laws like Louisiana's weren't in place. You know, many people in the pro-life movement have made the point that what Roe did in practice was simply to legalize the back alley. It didn't change the nature of abortion. It didn't make abortion into a medical procedure. It didn't make it into a healthy experience. It just took what was happening, supposedly, in the back alleys in America prior to Roe and put it in a somewhat medicinal-seeming setting without regulation. And so it's like, why would an abortion practitioner not have hospital admitting privileges? Not because the procedure is safe, but because the law insulates them from any kind of oversight, which we wouldn't accept from a dentist, let alone a normal physician. So that takes us to the poll results that we're looking at here today. We've looked at the issues at the heart of June Medical Services versus Gee, and so we want to now say, substantively, what do Americans think about the issues at stake? First, 70% of those surveyed agree that abortion facilities should be held to the same medical standards as any ordinary hospital. So what does that mean? That means just that a physician who can practice in a hospital should be of the same stature as the sort of practitioner who would provide for an abortion. 70% agree with that. That's a pretty high figure. 73.8% support the power of states being able to pass safeguards to ensure abortion facilities are in compliance with basic medical practices and sanitation. So just slightly higher. So we've gone from saying that in principle, abortion facilities should be held to the same medical standards as any ordinary hospital, to slightly more Americans agreeing that states should actually be allowed to mandate this, which makes sense. You know, if you believe one, you're going to believe the other. Now, here's where it really starts to jump. A vast majority of Americans, 78.2% of those surveyed in this Americans United for Life YouGov poll, believe that physicians performing abortions should be able to transfer women who experience complications directly to the emergency room. 78.2% of Americans believe this. Again, when we say common sense, the polling data shows that to be the case. When you ask somebody substantively about this, you respond in a natural way. Nearly 80% of Americans have an opinion that is going to the U.S. Supreme Court. The fact that we even have to litigate this to the U.S. Supreme Court, I think, is a sign of the divisiveness of our times, the bizarro world.
So as Tom just said, almost 80% of Americans surveyed in this poll in a representative sample of the U.S. population believe that women who are getting an abortion should be able to be immediately transferred to a hospital. But here's the kicker. 43% of the people in this poll consider themselves pro-choice. So it broke down 43% pro-choice, 35% pro-life, and 23% said neither. So that means that a substantial number of the people who consider themselves pro-choice agree that the Louisiana law is a good idea, something that should be in, and almost all of the people who said they are neither pro-life or pro-choice. What does that tell us, Alexandra?
I mean, frankly, I think the fact that anybody is arguing against this law just tells you how detached from reality the pro-abortion movement has gotten and how it really is a pro-abortion movement and not a women's healthcare movement and not a pro-woman movement and not a pro-choice movement. And not an abortion rights movement even, because at this point we're talking about women who can freely go to an abortion clinic. We're not restricting the abortion clinics in any way. We're just asking that the people performing the abortions are able to obtain emergency medical services for a woman who is freely exercising her supposed right to get an abortion procedure. And that is being opposed by not those women, not a woman saying, hey, I wanted an abortion, I couldn't get one because of this law, but the guy who's performing the abortion essentially now is saying, hey, sorry, these women really aren't gonna be able to get one if I can't keep making money off of this. I mean, obviously I'm dumbing it down a little bit, but that's the gist of what's going on
here.
You're
so right.
We hear all the time about how this is women's healthcare and abortion's a healthcare issue, and it's about women being able to get the services that they need. Women can't get the healthcare services that they need if they can't get into an emergency room after experiencing complications from abortion. And it's just not going to happen.
The lowest bar you could set. Right?
I mean, come on.
You can believe that abortion is a fundamental constitutional right. You can believe it's the most important human right in the world and still think that if something goes wrong, you should be able to take the patient to the hospital. But the abortion clinics are saying that that's an abridgment, right? So everything is a violation of their right, even just taking care, basically, of their patients?
I mean, the only people who oppose this law are the people who stand to financially lose from the fact that their abortionist cannot, usually because they're a shady character and an unsafe medical practitioner, can't get emergency admitting privileges for some reason. It's about their bottom line at the end of the day. And we're told no one wants to talk about this law. No one wants to talk about these cases because it reveals the abortion industry for what it is. And it shows that they're not out to protect women. They're not out to push women's health care. They're out to just make sure that they can keep performing abortions regardless of the risk to women who come in and get them.
Yeah, and to underscore this, so in a poll where nearly 80% of American respondents believe that physicians performing abortions should be able to transfer women who experience complications directly to the emergency room to receive the care they need, I can't underscore this enough, 65-some percent of respondents are saying, I'm not pro-life. 65% are saying they're either pro-choice or nothing in terms of their perspective on the issue. Where are we left when we look at what the U.S. Supreme Court might do with this case? Are we able to make solid predictions about the U.S. Supreme Court's decision-making at this point?
I have no idea. I mean, I would have bet they wouldn't even take the case. So my prediction power with the Supreme Court is not very strong. I think if they were to rule in a pro-state regulating abortion restrictions way at all, this would be the kind of case where they could, because it's not even about limiting the abortion procedure itself in any way. There's a very clear state interest, you would think, in treating abortion like any other medical procedure, making sure that women have the medical care that they need. So I really don't see the case for not ruling that way. But again, I would have said that about very many other cases that they ruled a different way. So
I'm of dual mind. I think that them taking the case is a very good sign, actually. I think that we have new justices on the court who have not ruled on abortion yet. And I think that my money would be on it going in our direction and them ruling in favor of the state of Louisiana and their right to regulate this practice. But I recently spoke to Clark Forsyth, our senior counsel here, who was around back during Planned Parenthood v. Casey. And he was saying that prior to that case, that people thought there might be 7 votes on the court to overturn Roe, you know, because there was all of these new justices who have been appointed by pro-life presidents who people thought might vote against Roe, and that turned out 5-4 in the other direction. So we definitely can't be sure. Like we said earlier, whenever the court speaks on abortion, it sets nationwide precedent.
A key thing too is that, you know, Clark's right, there very well may have been 7 votes to overturn Roe, but what happened? The intervention of politics and political influence. This is the thing that judges, to their credit, strive to avoid. I do respect, you know, when Justice Roberts and others talk about the idea of there not being, you know, Obama judges or Trump judges or Bush judges.
Just calling balls and strikes.
You know, just exactly, right? They're just the referees. That's a beautiful principle. The reality is that the court intersects with the political spectrum in most of the issues that they deal with, most of the high-profile issues at least. And so, you know, when the court in 92, for instance, decided to say, well, we're going to uphold the central finding of Roe as we've just decided it, and when they ruled the way they did, they're engaging with politics. It's unavoidable. And so, you know, Steve Aden here has made the point that for the court to engage the issue of abortion is to engage politics, and for the court to avoid the issue of abortion is to engage politics. There's no way out of the trap. It needs to kind of cut through the maze that it's created and resolve this definitively for America. And that would look like a return to the states. This issue is something that the media does a poor job of reporting on, generally, National Review accepted. But I want to share, before we get into some of the stuff you've been writing on recently, Alexandra, an experience I had recently in dealing with a major city newspaper. You know, Catherine Glenn Foster, our president and CEO here, spoke recently at the National Constitution Center and wrote an op-ed for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And in dealing with the Philadelphia Inquirer, you know, placing this op-ed, helping answer questions that their editorial team had, the initial headline that the Philadelphia Inquirer paired with Catherine's op-ed, and of course, you know, newspapers write the headlines generally. You know, we didn't supply a headline, we supplied the op-ed. The newspaper put a headline to the effect that we were advocating for a reversal of Roe, which would result in the imposition of an abortion ban nationwide. That was the initial headline. And so, of course, like within minutes of receiving this email, I emailed them back with a very polite sort of, hey, you know, FYI, that's not what the reversal of Roe would do. If Roe were reversed tomorrow, it would not impose a national ban. It would actually return the issue to the states. And what does that mean? It would return abortion as an issue to the democratic process. Voters would get to decide the issue on a state-by-state level. But when an editorial team at a top 10 American Metro newspaper doesn't have, you know, whatever, the depth of experience on the issue to know that, and even further, doesn't consult experts, domain experts on it, but just goes with what their assumption is, that in itself is sort of a little vignette. It's a case study in how we are in this place in America where Americans don't know generally what would happen, and where we, in fact, sort of assume whatever our kind of worst biases are on the issue, we just assume, well, that must be correct, because we've never had an experience of somebody making a different case, let alone, in this case, just, you know, a straight factual case. So that takes us to media and reporting in general. There's good news, though, right, Alexander? There's a recent piece by Caitlin Flanagan in The Atlantic, The Dishonesty of the Abortion Debate, and you wrote a response to this. Can you kind of unpack her piece and your response to it?
Yeah, I definitely recommend it to listeners. I saw the headline on The Atlantic, and I just did this internal cringe, and I forced myself to click and start reading, and it ended up being just a really powerful, really thoughtful piece, and I'm grateful that she wrote it. The majority of the piece is about this, you know, older methods of abortion and how dangerous they were for women, some of the complications that different women suffered.
Some hard stories.
It's a really tough piece to read. So I guess maybe trigger warning of some kind. It's definitely a little bit grisly, but it's worth reading because I think as pro-lifers, we're perfectly willing to acknowledge that women face difficult healthcare repercussions from abortion, not only in these, you know, quote, unsafe older abortion methods, but today too. And that's something we don't talk about. And it does not undercut the case against abortion to acknowledge that that happens. I think, in fact, it strengthens the case against abortion because it shows that, in fact, it's not really a boon to women, as we're told. But there's also this section in her essay where she talks about the ultrasound and just how that has essentially opened a window into the womb to see that these are human beings. And she writes exactly that, you know, these are human beings. This is a baby picture. And it's a really powerful part of the essay. And she sort of concludes by saying this debate is unwinnable and we have a dishonest abortion debate because on one side we have people who are, you know, very passionate about abortion rights. They say, shout your abortion. And the liberal people tend to just, you know, demonize those on the other side, say abortion should be legal no matter what. And then you have, you know, anti-abortion people who suggest that women who have abortions are murderers or sucking babies out of them or whatever, all sorts of terrible rhetoric. And that's true up to a point, but my small criticism of the piece is I think, by and large, the pro-life movement is not characterized by those sorts of people. It's characterized by crisis pregnancy centers and by, you know, post-abortive counseling groups and all these people who exist to tell women that they deserve better than abortion. That is the overarching theme of one of the overarching themes of the pro-life movement. And I think that really, that undercuts this argument that, well, there's just kind of dishonest people on both sides. Of course, every movement has its cranks, but on the left side of this issue, we have people who look at ultrasounds or, you know, maybe don't look at ultrasounds and just say, these aren't human beings. This is a clump of cells, or I don't care what it is. It's inside a woman's body so she can do what she wants. We can't have an honest debate about abortion because only one side of this debate will acknowledge that these are human beings. And if I could find pro-abortion people or pro-choice people who would say, yes, this is a human being, but abortion should be a woman's right anyway because, and then fill in the blank, I will have a conversation with that person gladly any day of the week. And it's a difficult conversation. I don't agree with that outcome, but at least we've established the premise that this, you know, the undeniable premise that this is a human being. And I think that's really missing from our conversation.
So I'm going to read a few sentences from the piece in The Atlantic. This is in reference to 3D ultrasounds. Quote, for a long time, these images made me anxious. They are proof that what grows within a pregnant woman's body is a human being, living and unfolding according to a timetable that has existed as long as we have. Obviously, it would take a profound act of violence to remove him from his quiet world and destroy him. This author ends the piece saying that she somewhat reluctantly still supports unlimited abortion. How do we take that? I mean, it seems like she's admitting personhood. It seems like she's saying that abortion is an act of violence. Those are things that we say all the time, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I would have to reread the end of her essay again. I don't know if it's fair to characterize her as still favoring abortion on demand. She seems to me to be sort of somewhere in the middle on the issue.
I think that's fair, yeah.
Yeah, but I think, you know, that's at least a step in the right direction to be able to acknowledge that this is a human being. And I don't really... in one sense, obviously respect somebody who says this is a human being and a woman ought to have the right to kill it. But I do respect them for being honest about that, because every conversation I can think of, the vast overwhelming majority of conversations I can think of or pieces that I've read or exchanges that I've had about abortion, the other side does not want to admit that premise. And fair enough, that's a very difficult case to make, that killing a human being is okay. But until you're admitting that, we're not having a conversation about the heart of the issue. And the pro-life case is not that we should be able to control women's bodies or that women don't have rights. The case is women do have rights, but one of them is not killing a human being. And so I think she gets very close to putting her finger on exactly what ails our abortion debate.
Yeah, there's a excerpt in there where she says that the argument for abortion requires many words. The argument against it doesn't take even a single word. And she's speaking to this issue that you've highlighted, Alexandra, of these sonograms, these products of these 3D ultrasounds are baby pictures. That's why it doesn't take a single word. Look at the picture.
Yeah, and we all know that when people hang up an ultrasound picture at their cubicle at work, we don't say, hey, nice clump of cells you got there. Like, no, we know it's a baby, right? It's only when the mother says, well, I can't for whatever reason, that suddenly we're supposed to pretend it's no longer a human being.
There's a great artist local, I think, to the DC area, Caitlin Solon, who does sonogram art for people who get a sonogram, and she'll turn it into a real work of art, a painting or something else that they can make a part of their home. People don't do that sort of thing with like medical waste or with just like general tumor, biological, yeah. Products. They do it with something that is life-giving, that is hope-giving, that is future-oriented. All the things that characterize a developing human being, as we talked about with David Perennis here on the program from the Charlotte Lozier Institute, when we look at just the story of human development, where we come from. And that's what I think her piece did, Caitlin Flanagan's piece did a real service to their readers in The Atlantic by, addressing this in a way that to some degree is outside of politics. It was helpful to have her speak to the issue this way. And I thought your response to her piece was helpful as well. Shifting gears a bit, Katrina Jackson, we've talked about from Louisiana, is a great pro-life Democrat, but she is an exception in her party today. Why is that?
Yeah, and I wrote a piece actually recently on this for the National Review print magazine, which was prompted by the latest Democratic debate, where you had Representative Tulsi Gabbard from Hawaii, who once was a pro-lifer, unfortunately no longer is, but she used this kind of old Democratic Party catchphrase, abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. And she said, I'd support codifying Roe, whatever that means. But I also would, restrict abortion in the last 3 months of pregnancy. And she ended up being just absolutely piled on by progressives who said, why should this be rare? Abortion is a right. And if you say it's rare, then it's stigmatizing to women. And she actually got some backup from the former president of Planned Parenthood, Lena Wen, who was, as we all probably know, was ousted by Planned Parenthood for not being perhaps pro-abortion enough or as interested in political activism to expand abortion rights. But both of them just were absolutely eviscerated by the vast majority of people on the left for suggesting that maybe we should try to reduce the demand for abortions. And I think that's really telling that Tulsi Gabbard, first of all, is the only Democratic candidate who would even approximate anything like this. Safe, legal, and rare is just...
Which also, like, safe, legal, and rare,
gone.
That's not even, like, a concrete policy position. People just got angry at her for, like, the rhetoric of it. Even just the idea that abortion isn't something to be celebrated is enough to be completely...
Exactly.
Pushed off stage, right?
Yeah, and I think that's why we've seen the Democratic Party move so far to the left on this, because the abortion rights notion that abortion is not a necessary evil to be tolerated, but rather a social good that we should maybe even promote or cheer or celebrate so that women don't feel stigmatized, that has really taken over the Democratic Party in terms of policy and especially in terms of rhetoric. And it's really unfortunate, because I think that is not only where most Americans are on the issue, it's not where most Democrats are on the issue.
And even like the Flanagan piece we were talking about before, that approach of saying abortion should be legal is much more palatable to people than this gleeful approach that like abortion is great. Like it makes people uncomfortable. Even so many pro-choice people, if you're just saying that there is nothing wrong with abortion and that it doesn't make us even uncomfortable a little bit, like that's alienated even to a lot of people who think it should be legal.
It also, I think, it is really harmful to women who've had an abortion and are regretful about that choice. And there are plenty of women like that who we never hear about because they're sort of shoved in a back room by people who think we need to talk about abortion as if it's this one size fits all solution to every problem.
Well, we're told that there are no women who regret their abortions, than any who stand up to share their story of regret or just poor experience in general. We're told that they are being used as propaganda. We're told that they're plants. It's a devaluation of the experience of people who've had a hard experience and who deserve to be heard. You know, this issue is one where I think, you know, any debate, you deserve to have sort of your best argument considered, right? And, you know, that goes in this case doubly so for the debate over life with pro-life and pro-choice Americans. And the fact that pro-choice Americans have shifted now, at least their elite, their leadership has shifted to this idea that no, the new consensus must be of abortion as a positive good. It puts them in a position where they're actually advancing their worst argument. You know, their best argument for abortion historically has been something where Americans can actually come together and address the concerns. Their, you know, best argument, quote unquote, you know, can be said as something to the effect that women who would even consider an abortion are in such a difficult place financially, familially, personally, in terms of their job, in terms of their day-to-day situation, that they would feel the need to have to make this decision, you know, and bracketing the fact that when you feel forced into one decision, that's not actually the exercise of free choice anyway, but that's essentially been the argument. And if that remains the truth of the situation, which I think it is for a huge number of people who have to face that decision, that's something where Americans can come together and provide a response, a social response. We can say there are social policies we can put in place, even aside from the role that neighbors can play, that communities can play, that families can play in helping stand in solidarity and stand alongside women in situations like that. We can also enact state-level and national-level policies to help improve the state of things in America. And yet, they've abandoned, you know, this sort of reality-based position for just a really tragic position that, again, devalues so many of the women who've been through this and advances sort of the most bizarre world perspective on why abortion should even be an issue of national consequence.
Everyone should read Alexandra's piece, Safe, Legal, and Unlimited, a great headline. I don't know if you wrote that headline.
I did, actually, for once. It was the first time one of my magazine headline suggestions was accepted by the editor.
I'm going to read a little excerpt from her piece. Quote, in their haste to appease progressive activists, Democrats have made unlimited abortion a cornerstone of their platform, leaving behind not only the average American, but many of their own voters in the process. And that's what I think is so astute about your piece, Alexandra, is our poll bears that out, right? Is that so many people who are pro-choice, who may say they're Democrats, support these common sense regulation on abortion, but now the national party is making it very challenging to publicly hold that position.
Yeah, and I understand why, you know, Democratic voters obviously are Democrats for a whole host of reasons, but I think on this issue, they've been absolutely just left behind by nearly all of their politicians, and I don't see any way it can get better because the money and the activism, unfortunately, is pushing exactly in the other direction.
So the U.S. Supreme Court is going to consider so many of these issues in 2020 when they take up the case of June Medical Services versus Gee, and they're going to, by definition, engage in political decision-making, because whatever their decision is, it's going to impact American politics. We're going to see a lot of polls. We're going to see a lot of opinions over the next 6 to 9 months. The court, timeline-wise, is going to hear oral arguments most likely in February, and following past precedent, will most likely hand down its decision in June. The timeline could change. The court can decide to do whatever it wants ultimately, but that's likely what we're going to see. And so as we see this issue come to the fore, especially in the spring of 2020, it bears in mind, it's worth bearing in mind that numbers like these, 70%, 73.8%, 78.2%, majorities in favor of common sense health and safety regulations, these are the sort of figures that can help guide the court's thinking so that worst case, even if it's thinking, we don't want to touch politics, it can look at data like this, data, again, from a majority of respondents who don't identify as pro-life, and at least be comfortable with the idea that they can hand down a ruling that affirms common sense health and safety regulations sponsored by Representative Katrina Jackson, a Democrat in Louisiana. Not the place you'd expect or the party you'd expect to be the champion for a common sense health and safety regulation that impacts abortion. So we're going to continue to follow this case. Alexandra, Noah, thank you for helping unpack a lot of these issues and helping explain this in a way that I hope is clear. All right, Alexandra, as you know, something we do every show is our shot of gratitude. So hope you're prepared. What is your shot of gratitude?
I'm grateful that I was able to spend about 5 days back at my alma mater, Notre Dame, over this past weekend. I was there for the Center for Ethics and Culture's annual fall conference, considering the theme of friendship. I Have Called You Friends was the title of the conference. Heard some great panel presentations, and also ended up having two flight cancellations in a row because of a snowstorm that came in late Sunday night, but I was not complaining. It was a nice extension of a great trip.
That's awesome.
That's fantastic. I love it when a delay like that can be a moment where you can have gratitude. And
actually be excited instead of, think
of all the things I'm benefiting from missing my two planes.
All right, Noah, how about you? What is your shot of gratitude?
I just read Rich Lowry's new book, The Case for Nationalism, and it's really interesting in a lot of ways, but something I was thinking of as we come up on Thanksgiving is he sort of skewers the idea that people say a lot is that America is an idea, or America, most importantly, is an idea, not a place, and he says that the place of America is also very important. And as we reflect on the pilgrims and all the trouble that immigrants have gone through over the last couple hundred years of trying to come to the place that is America, I'm very thankful to be born here, and I'm very thankful to benefit from the institutions of liberty that we've been granted by our forefathers.
That's beautiful, Noah. Thank you so much. You know, I'm going to be going back up to the Philadelphia area for Thanksgiving to see family. And, you know, it reminds me of a number of places in the area. Valley Forge is, of course, one of the most famous there that played a pivotal role during the Revolution. You know, Thanksgiving, of course, predates America's founding, but it took on a unique character at America's founding. And there's a few monuments to the first national Thanksgiving, you know, as a United States in the Valley Forge area. And I want to just quote here from Sheila Vance, who provides some beautiful context for this. She writes that, "On December 18th, 1777, General George Washington's army celebrated the first national Thanksgiving in Gulf Mills and on Rebel Hill. The celebration caused a one-day delay in the army's march to Valley Forge, which General Washington had decided a day earlier was to be where the army would make its winter quarters. The purpose of the Thanksgiving, according to the November 1st, 1777 proclamation of the Continental Congress, was for, quote, solemn thanksgiving and praise, to inspire our commanders by both land and sea and all under them with that wisdom and fortitude which may render them fit instruments under the providence of Almighty God to secure for these United States the greatest of all human blessings, independence and peace," unquote. Isn't that incredible? I mean, this is a part of the history that, you know, Rich Lowry touches upon, in the sense that we're not just an idea as a country. You know, we're inspired by ideas. We're inspired by beautiful principles.
We're guided by ideas.
But all of this takes place in a physical context, with a physical history that we can encounter in places like Valley Forge and elsewhere. And wherever we're going back to in the country for Thanksgiving, wherever we're celebrating Thanksgiving with family and friends, we can remember that it's not about sort of the tired jokes about, you know, politics or religion conversations during Thanksgiving dinner, but it's about kind of entering into that spirit that animated the founding generation and that animated Americans across the centuries to just be grateful for the things that we have and to strive toward, you know, retaining that independence that was fought for, but also achieving a lasting peace. And that intersects exactly with the sort of issues that we're coming back to again and again, that the U.S. Supreme Court's going to consider, that Alexandra De Sanctis is going to help us consider in her writings, and that Noah, you'll guide us through on life, liberty, and law.
Thanks, Tom. I agree. That's really important to remember, and I hope that both you and Alexandra have a really great Thanksgiving with your families.
Thanks so much, Noah.
Thanks.
Alexandra, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, great to be with you.
Okay, if you enjoyed the show, please give us a rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Rate the show, leave a review, message a friend, let them know you've discovered life, liberty, and law. And be sure to follow Alexandra De Sanctis' work. Alexandra, where do people find you?
You can find all my writing, most of my writing, at nationalreview.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at Zan_DeSanctis.
I'm Tom Shakley, and until next time, thanks for listening to Life, Liberty, and Law.